In today's episode,
hey, I'm having 1800 calories and I'm burning 3000, and like A minus B is a negative number, so I'll be in a calorie deficit. Like, it's true, but then, okay, not all calories are the same. A really key factor is that certain calories are more satiating than others. So 100 calories of eggs is more satiating than 100 calories of a Snickers bar.
Okay, welcome to another episode of Create a Lab. We have a very special guest here today, Michael Brandt. Welcome to the show, my man.
Bilal, thanks for having me. It's going to be a fun conversation.
Yeah, so here's some background, because we've spoken a few times before, but we've always in the DMs texting each other. We actually haven't met in person yet, though I hope to change that soon. In November, I should be in your neck of the woods, so I'll give you a shout to do that in person finally. But we've spoken over the years. I know you are a listener of NIA, the Not Investment Advice Pod as well. And we've just been connected through Twitter, like many of the people on this show. But I realized when we had our first call, like I think a year ago, we actually worked together. I think we had some overlap at Google as well. Well, you were at Google for some time, so, but we didn't know each other back then. So yeah, let's just give people a sense of what you're working on and who you are. Why did I bring you on a show? I'll let you do the pitch for me.
All right. Yeah. Good to chat. It's fun how the internet works these days. Can meet all sorts of cool people and have great conversations without meeting in person yet. But yeah,
I know, it's crazy.
I'm here in LA. Let's get together. Let's get some pickleball, some curry, whatever. The next time you're in town.
Yeah, let's do it. So yeah, so you're the founder and CEO of HVMN. HVMN. I'm gonna make sure I'm saying that correctly. You've been essentially creating a new category of ketone shots. So we're gonna go into exactly what that is today and why people like the army, you know, elite athletes, and many biohackers are using your products. But yeah, is there anything else I'm missing out on that side?
Yeah, we could rewind the tape even further back. I think the Genesis story is always interesting, because it's not like one day I just woke up and had a multi-million dollar business and contracts with Special Operations Command and funding from Andreessen Horowitz. It very much, I believe, in the drunken walk of the entrepreneur. You start out with an intention, skills, passions, and you can just keep every day, wake up, chop wood, carry water, see where it takes you. So Genesis story there is I studied computer science in undergrad. I was an engineer, went to Stanford. Studied computer science and product design there. I have always been interested as an engineer in systems thinking. And what was really interesting to me around when I graduated, so a couple of years ahead of me, Kevin Systrom invented Instagram. A year behind me, Evan Spiegel invented Snapchat. I saw this proliferation of tech on the smartphone. Uber came out when I was in college. It seemed very mature and robust. And that seemed like it was kind of in that point in the adoption curve where the iPhone, it started to slow down and wasn't changing that much. Like, I don't know the difference between iPhone 8 and iPhone 9 and iPhone 10 or et cetera. It got to a spot where the phone was a very mature platform. And I opened my eyes, my co-founder and I opened our eyes. We're both computer science guys. And we said, hey, what is the next like big platform for innovation? Smartphone basically took over all the oxygen of the last decade, you know, desktop internet the decade prior to that. Our forward look is that the human body is the next platform for innovation, that the human body is actually the most advanced piece of technology you'll ever own. And you see all of this proliferation of, I'm wearing my Oura ring right now, people got smartwatches, people are tracking their footsteps, you tend to send a cheek swab away to 23andMe. We're learning to go a little nerdy here, like we're starting to open up the API of the human body. We are starting to see what is going on inside. We've been driving this car with no, like you've been driving a car with no dashboard lights whatsoever. And now all of a sudden you're starting to see, what's my RPMs? What's my oil gauge? How fast am I even going? You see cool stuff like your continuous glucose monitors, folks like Levels, NutriSense. We're truly, you could argue AirPods are a, you know, quasi implant. It's like an oral or an oral in the auditory sense implant where you have this passive listening device that's, you know, quasi installed in your brain. There's an argument to be made that like Apple has already invented the first mainstream implant. So we are becoming bionic, and the human body is the next platform for innovation. And what follows from that, of course, is that, okay, I know what my glucose levels is. I know what my sleep score is. what am I putting into my body? Like, how do I drive a better sleep result? Okay, let me not have caffeine afternoon. Let me, you know, when I'm really stressed or eating a lot of carbs, I don't feel good. How do I reduce that? How do I spend more time in ketosis, which we can get into? Like, how do I not be constantly on this sugar hamster wheel, more time fueling with ketones? So human body is the next platform for innovation. We're seeing this proliferation of hardware and sensors, and it follows from there that people are being more mindful about the inputs into their system, i.e. you know, your food, behavior, all of those that are driving outputs. So that was the macro. I can pause there for a sec. That was like the big insight of, like, you know, we should make an app. That still doesn't answer why we came to what exactly we came to, but that'd be the equivalent of, you know, in 2007 saying, oh, we should make a smartphone app because apps are the future. Like, that's what I graduated out of college with. You know, spent a couple of years at Google, but I was really interested in human body as a platform. Where do we go from here?
Got it. And just so to clarify, what does HVMN stand for? So that might give a sense of the macro idea of the company too.
That's right. It stands for Health Via Modern Nutrition.
All right, exactly. So yeah, and so I know you know, this has been, I think I heard about your company like some years ago, probably by like listening to Tim Ferriss or something like that, because I think he's the first person I'd heard kind of in the mainstream, if you count him as the mainstream, talking about, you know, like even ketosis for me, like the idea of ketosis, why anyone would even be in that state. Obviously in the last few years, there's been a huge, you know, trendy diet called the keto diet, which has been around for a long, long time. And has been used to treat people for medical reasons, but also a lot of like bodybuilders and people who are changing their, you know, body have used it as a tool as well. And then there's been like the negative side of it where people are potentially just abusing it in a way and like, you know, maybe not doing it in the most sustainable or healthy way as well. So maybe we can talk about that in a second. But I do want to just quickly show off for you. You mentioned a few of those things there. You've had funding from the likes of Andreessen Horowitz, Joe Montana, Hall of Fame NFL quarterback, Jake Paul, the celebrity YouTuber and boxer, and some of the kind of high-level stuff. When we did our call, I don't know if it's okay for me to say this, but I was considering an investment as well at some point in your company, and so I got to see a lot of the numbers and like all that sort of stuff, which I won't expose any of those until you're okay to do that. But just in terms of like seeing the potential of the business, that was something I was really interested in uncovering as well. So that was kind of like on the investor side. Is there anything you can share on the scale of the business? I don't know what you're allowed to share in terms of revenue ranges or number of people served, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, sure. And another interesting, Marissa Meyer, our old colleague from Google, YouTube invested. I was in her APM program. I was actually the last APM class that she hired, if that means anything to people anymore.
Yeah, amazing.
I went on the world trip with her and visited a bunch of international Google offices. And then she had a kind of standing policy of supporting ex-Google APMs and investing into any startups.
What does APM stand for people who aren't familiar with the lingo?
Yeah, already jumping into the tech jargon over here, my bad. It stands for Associate Product Manager. It's basically a management track at Google. A lot of the folks that have stayed around Google are now like senior product manager of Google Maps, Google Docs, that kind of thing. So very cool program. It was my dream job out of college. I had bills to pay before I set on my entrepreneurship journey, made a big dent, had a lot of fun. I was working at YouTube. And then when I left, I started really attacking that.
Yeah, amazing.
That the human body is a platform and innovating on business models there. Yeah. Where we're at as a business, so we're coming up on $1 million of revenue a month. We are mainly direct to consumer. We sell on Amazon. We just recently launched into Earth Bar, which a lot of people know. They're at the Equinox food service, like the cafe that you see at a lot of Equinoxes, especially on the West Coast. So we're mainly online, and we are now straddling into retail, going, I think the buzzword is omni-channel, where we're figuring out how to, hey, like the best brands are just everywhere. And you usually have we can talk more about this if it's interesting, which is like channel selection. Even the best omni-channel brands, you tend to have a hero brand. Like you always start somewhere, and that tends to end up being your hero brand long-term. For us, D2C is our hero brand, but we're taking our learnings from there and expanding into other channels now. We can say a fun topic if we want to come back to it, but
So that's great context for the size. Just to go into a few of those kind of segments, because you've got the direct-to-consumer business, but then I also mentioned earlier the army and military. So this is probably going to get into the question around why someone in the army would be using ketones or exogenous ketones, stuff like that. But could you give me a sense of like what those segments are for your business? Because D2C is one big part, but there seems to be another part here too.
Yeah. And good to answer quickly, what the hell even is a ketone?
Yeah, great point. Let's do that.
A lot of people have heard about a ketone via the keto diet, which is a weight loss diet where you're making ketones as a byproduct. And you can think of it like you're sawing wood and ketones are the sawdust. And it turns out that the sawdust itself is liquid superfuel. That's the big insight here, is it's not just this byproduct that you're body happens to make, you're burning fat, turning it into ketones. That's been a lot of the framing around ketones for the last, I don't know, 5-10 years. Keto diet, get beach bod ready, get into your wedding dress or your groomsman suit, whatever. It works for rapid weight loss. Do keto diet for 60 days. Like that, it tends to work. Question mark for like long term. Some people swear by it. Most people I talk to, they'll try it for a sprint and then they'll kind of bounce back to maybe not the standard American diet, because they'll usually bounce back to something that's more sugar conscious. You don't go like, you don't go all the way back to, you know,
zero sugar
Reese's Puffs for breakfast, right? Like you go back to a modified standard diet that's lower carb, which I think is a great, you know, great directionally. Anyway, so ketones as a drink, it's orthogonal to the keto diet. You can do it with the keto diet, because if you're doing the keto diet, you already have ketones swimming around in your system. The genesis for us was that when we created the world's first ketone drink, we got in 2019, we got a $6 million contract with the United States Department of Defense Special Operations Command. And they're not doing keto diet. They're strictly stacking ketones as a liquid superfuel on top of their standard diet. And that's where it has these interesting benefits, where it's just this novel substrate for your metabolism. It's basically this premium gas if you're at the gas pump. And really, really practically, the way to use it, I'm a marathoner, triathlete. So what I do is I have my bottle on my bike and I load it up. Sometimes I'll use like Morton or Goo, or I'll have some carbs in there. And then I'll have in a 3-to-1 ratio, I'll put in ketone IQ. And that blend, there's something about having these dual forms of fuel instead of just going all the way carbs or all the way ketones, but having them blended together and having access to both. They go through different highways into your metabolism. So like you can only have so much carbs at a time before that highway has a traffic jam. So being able to get energy into your cell, into your mitochondria via these parallel different pathways is very advantageous.
Okay, so just to pause there for a second, thank you for that explanation. So just to clarify, for a lot of people, they might have heard of the keto diet. They've probably read it in a magazine or headline, positive or negative. Some people listening might have even tried it. But to clarify, you said you can produce... So like when people do the keto diet, the theory is, from my understanding, you reduce your sugar and your carbs to such a small amount, normally below 20 grams per day, or net carbs is normally the phrase used, 20 to 40, depending on the person. And when you deplete your body of that glucose, essentially, because it normally turns into glucose, your body then switches from one source of fuel being glucose to essentially fat, and ketones are produced, is my understanding. And then those are the fuel source that your body ends up using. Is that correct? Or did I say the last part might be slightly inaccurate?
You got it totally correct. Yeah. What happens is your body, when you're running low on sugar, starts to look for alternate fuel sources and it starts to turn fat into ketones. There's a key factor here, which is that the human brain can use sugar and it can use ketones, but it cannot use fat. Fat molecules are too large. So when you're running low on blood sugar, your brain is big. I mean, your brain is big, but no, the human brain, is big. It's single digit. It's like 5% of our body weight and 20 to 25% of our total energy demand. So it's a big piece of machinery that we have, and it can't use fat. So you're on the savanna. You haven't eaten. Reese's peanut butter cups haven't been invented for another 10,000 years. You haven't had any sugar or carbs, and you haven't maybe even eaten in a day or two. Do you keel over and die? No, like we have this evolutionary adaptation to be able to turn fat into ketones to supply our big brains. So
got it. So
No, I just say one fine-tuned clarification on it too, is that it is not this on-off switch. It's not like all of a sudden, wa-boom, like you become, you ramp into ketosis. There's truly shades of gray between a standard American diet with way too much sugar, constant elevated blood sugar, not good for you, versus like what you said, like 20 grams, like very minimal carbs to where your body has basically no carbs and is producing a ton of ketones. There's shades of gray in between. And I think that is worth saying just because a lot of how the keto diet has been presented is this like special underpants club.
Underpants club. That's hilarious.
It reminds me of like veganism, where it used to be like, oh, it's like you're vegan or not. Now there's like plant-based. It's like you can kind of...
Or flexitarian is another one I've heard recently. But no, you're right. And that's a good thing to bring up. I just wanted to share the kind of high level. The other thing I'd share is anyone who's ever cut weight, ideally when you're cutting weight, you're actually not just cutting fat. Like if you're on a diet, like 99% of people have ever been on, let's say right now I'm on a cut, I'm eating about 1800 to 2000 calories a day. I might burn 3000 a day through exercise and normal metabolic functions. So that means 500 to 1000 calories a day I have a deficit. And that the theory is if you do that for a long enough period of time, you should cut your weight. Now, there's also when you cut your weight, it's not just a matter of 100% of it is coming from fat. You could be burning muscle, right? Like you could be using muscle and actually depleting your muscle mass. That's why a lot of people have tried to have a minimum amount of protein per day to maintain muscle mass and stuff like that. But there's also water in the body. So like when you measure yourself, it's not just your fat has gone down, that sort of stuff. But the theory is that for a lot of people who are pro the keto diet and why it is quite effective is because you're kind of switching your body into mostly burning fat and your body becomes fat adapted. And that is apparently the theory. Now, someone else might argue, and we're going to get to this in the second half of the show, that you don't need to do ketosis or do keto diet. You can eat vegan, you can eat carnivore, you can eat whatever, standard American diet and still lose weight. So, and I think that's kind of an interesting idea to bring up now, because a lot of people argue about nutrition. This was actually one of the things I mentioned in our kind of show notes before, our notes in prep for this, is that to me, like, we've become less religious in the West and we've replaced it with veganism, you know, Peloton and CrossFit, right? And what I mean by that is people have found new things to be, you know, tribal about. And the number one thing I see people arguing about in this world is my way is the right way, your one is wrong. And so that is kind of like kind of a precursor to all of this, is we're not saying everything we're saying today is not, first of all, health advice. Like, people should do their own research and speak to their doctors if they're making any of these changes. At the same time, we're just going to be sharing like stuff that's worked for us, and you're obviously involved with this every single day. So I want to get your take on all of this. So the other thing I wanted to mention there, you mentioned your brain is not able to just use fat. So does that mean the rest of your body can? Like, what does that process actually look like?
Yeah, we're like skeletal muscle tissue can use fat and it can use ketones, but your brain can't. It has to do with your brain has a very selective membrane. You have this blood brain barrier. It protects your brain mainly. Like, you can't just let arbitrary molecules into your brain. It's a very sensitive organ. And so fat, it is too large. Fatty acids, as they are circulating, large.
So it needs to basically convert from those fatty acids to something that the brain can use, right?
That's right. And there's a lot that follows on from there too, because for instance, I'm drinking ketone right now. It's like when you drink Ketone IQ, our product, you get elevated ketones. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. So that's why you feel this immediate lift, and there's no sugar, there's no caffeine, and you're getting this immediate brain benefit. Our research team is working with a few different areas of investigation around concussions and traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's, due to the idiosyncrasies of how ketones are metabolized. You know, when you get a concussion, there's damage done at the moment of impact, and then there's swelling that takes place that results in a reduction of glucose metabolism, sugar metabolism. So fat already can't get in. Glucose normally can't you normally can, but when you have a concussion, there is a reduction in glucose metabolism in your brain. Ketones, however, because they go through this other pathway, they potentially rescue brain activity in that context, which is a very hot topic right now. It's like in the NFL right now, people are talking about concussion protocols, what
yeah,
happens.
I saw that Miami player was still on the field when he had a concussion or something like that. And I know in the Premier League this weekend, which I follow, Gabriel Jesus for the Arsenal team went down, looked completely knocked out, and everyone was like, hey, this guy needs to get off the pitch. And then 5 minutes later, he's running around. And that's quite a hot topic, like you said, because we don't really have the same rules and regulations there yet, because it's obviously very different in the NFL, where you're bumping against people literally every play. So it's a little bit of a different idea there. So so I'm not making sure people who have never heard of this topic before fully understand, we've talked about the different types of fuel that your body can use. So again, like to clarify, is there more than just glucose and fat/ketones, or is there other stuff in there that we should be talking about?
There are other ones. For instance, a lot of people have heard about lactic acid. It's kind of misunderstood as the thing that makes you sore after working out. Lactic acid itself has energy inside of it, and it's part of your mitochondria. People remember their high school biology. The mitochondria is the power plant of the cell. Your mitochondria can use a variety of different substrates. The main ones are your glucose, fat, ketones, but there's other ones as well, like lactic acid, lactate. And then there's other cofactors, things that you need alongside of those. Those are really the main ones, yeah.
Okay, got it. And so now we get to this idea of exogenous ketones and versus producing them yourself. So the word exogenous, I've heard that for like years and was like, why are they using this unnecessarily large word? It just means something external, I guess, right? Like something you're getting.
I think about it like Spider-Man has an exoskeleton.
There we go.
Outside of your body. Spiders have exoskeleton. Humans have an endoskeleton. So endogenous is it's within your body. So if you don't eat, I once did a 7-day fast. My body is endogenously creating ketones versus if I go and sip a ketone, that's an exogenous ketone.
That's a great explanation. So yeah, I just think exo as well, like for what you just said there. So there's now we've talked about different types of fuel sources, glucose, fat, ketones, lactic acid. Now we're going down level into ketones specifically, and we're saying you can produce ketones yourself, like you said, through certain ways of eating/fasting is a very popular one nowadays. If anyone does intermittent fasting listening to this, which I'm sure a lot of you are, because that's stuff we've talked about in the show and I'm sure you're interested in it, it's very likely that if you're doing like an 18-hour fast, 20-hour fast, you'll probably start to produce some ketones. Like if you did got a little ketone blood test thing right on my desk right now. I did it a few days ago. I haven't done it for ages, and I had 0.7 millimolars, I think.
It's a real number.
That's right? A real number, right? So
above 0.5, you start to feel it. Generally people feel then.
Exactly. So I've done like keto before, like actual deep keto, where I've got into like 2.0 millimolars and stuff like that. I was looking at my records. I've like gone really deep into it. And I actually have noticed, you know, people talk about this like clarity of thought, this feeling of like you kind of feel euphoric almost. Like just today it's 4:35. And I just had my first like real meal of the day, like an hour and a half ago. It was like a big smoothie. And now I'm about to have a dinner tonight. But that long fasting period for me just like makes me feel great. The mental clarity I get from it is actually one of the main reasons I do it. So that is me doing it without drinking your drink, which is nicely visible behind you if people are watching on YouTube. Most people are only listening, but yeah, we're going to get into the product itself. So we've talked about ketones. Now let's talk about exogenous ketones, why you guys have developed this as essentially a shot or something. I see you're sipping on it like it's a fine tequila. So let's talk about this idea of exogenous ketones and kind of where the whole idea came from in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said as well about fasting and that clarity. Like Plato would have his students fast. Fasting is part of every major religion, right? You have Ramadan, you have Yom Kippur, you have Lent. You have fasting as part of this like ascetic ritual of every major religion. So there's definitely a focus. And a lot of that focus is driven by the fact that Like sugar is really bad and distracting. You get this very intense spike when you eat something sugary, and then your body releases a lot of insulin, and that addresses that spike in blood sugar. And then the blood sugar crashes down, and then you still have this high ambient insulin, and that sends a signal to your brain that you're hungry and you need more sugar. So it very much is this chasing the dragon kind of substance. Like, sugar is way worse than I think people will give it credit for. A lot of people are calling it the new cigarettes, right? It's very, very addicting. Really hasn't been around long in modern human history. Like, we didn't have refined table sugar until the last couple hundred years. That's a big part of what drove British colonialism and a lot of other things, which we can talk about, but a little bit of a
I'm actually curious. Could we go into that for a second? I'm actually really interested. I didn't know it was only a few hundred years. And if you consider we've been around for however many years, do you know what the origin was? Why did it start to proliferate our, human species, essentially? Because we've always had fruits, right? Like, for a long time, if you were a dude rummaging through the jungle, there would maybe be fruits and you'd get these berries or something, but you might only get those once every like 6 days. Or something like that, right? Because you'd actually be foraging for stuff. So, but now we go downstairs and you get like any fruit you want.
Yeah, yeah. And if you wanted honey, you had to go climb the tallest tree and get stung by a bunch of bees. Like, there was just not that pure, refined source of sugar around. Yeah. So table sugar that existed in tropical climates, and it comes from the sugar cane, and it does not grow in Europe. It grows in the Caribbean, and then it's been exported to other places to grow. And so that was one of the drivers of mercantilism, colonialism, the slave trade, was like, hey, the whole species basically got addicted to sugar and spices and all of that. That's why rum, sugarcane, all that stuff, like tobacco, those are a lot of cotton. These are a lot of the slave crops. And that really came up in the last, Columbus sailed the ocean blue in 1492. Like, that would have been the earliest that these things started to get discovered. I forget when, Marco Polo, Magellan, all in that era. That was when people were first putting out initial feelers. And then obviously like global colonialism developed around it. But the point is that it just didn't really exist. Like, you had fruit in nature, but fruit is already way different than straight sugar. Like, there's a massive difference between having a handful of blueberries versus the same amount of sugar, just in a spoonful of sugar, because
blueberries fiber as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the fiber, you can think of it. I think this is borrowed from our friends over at Levels, who I believe was it Casey Means was on the pod. And
I've had both of the two founders, Josh,
right.
And so I've had them on twice. We talked about a lot of these ideas, by the way. So if you've never listened to that, you're listening, you can go back to the original one with Josh. We talked about metabolic health and kind of why sugar is a bigger problem than people think.
It's a great episode, and we're solving, I would say, two halves of the same coin. Like, we're climbing the same mountain together. They're coming at it from the hardware side, we're coming at it from the caloric input side. And one framing that they use is that the fiber inside of fruit acts as a brake. So you have the same mass of sugar coming into your system. It's just you're tapping the brakes on it. So you're not going to have this massive spike and crash in blood glucose. You'll have the same amount, but it will be over, it's just a more gentle curve. You may have the same area under the curve, but those spikes are what's really bad for you. Those like intense spikes of Coca-Cola is the worst thing, right? Like, pure candy from the store, all that stuff is like very spiky on your blood glucose. So having the same amount of net carbohydrate, but from oatmeal, where it takes your body a long time to break that down, or from fruits, natural sources, it's not the same. So
yeah.
It's all to say it's complicated, and I think this is leads into that conversation with kind of like the holy wars, where people try to see it black and white. Kind of reminds me of like Bitcoin versus Ethereum maxis.
Yeah.
You have like keto maxi versus not keto, or
like vegan versus carnivores. That's the one I see on TikTok and Instagram. And another kind of like kind of axes I would put is the calories in, calories out side of things versus that there's more complexity to it. And like, so a lot of like health, you know, like influencers, essentially, if you want to call them that, especially like a lot of like gym dudes, essentially, like people that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
You know, they're obviously trying to find, you know, black and white things to say that are like short and digestible, yeah. Right? Because most people don't want to listen to a 2-hour podcast about the nuance of metabolic health and what insulin really does to you and stuff like that. They're just saying, my current goal is to cut 10 pounds because I've got to wear my wedding suit in 3 months or whatever, right? Yeah, and that, and they conflate that short-term goal with long-term health. And when someone uses the word healthy, it could mean I'm overweight, therefore I need to cut a certain amount of weight, which is healthy. Or it could be I'm stick skinny and I need to put on some muscle because my body is not supported correctly. Or I'm an athlete and I need to perform better at my sport, whatever. So there's so many different parts of that spectrum. And that was kind of the summary. If there was one, a 30-second summary of that, those two episodes I had with the Levels guys, was the whole reason they exist is to give people the tools to find out their individual wants and needs for food specifically. And that, yeah, there might be some overarching trends, but a lot of the time, like, we need to figure out what works for us. So yeah, I don't know if that's oversimplifying it, but no, that was kind of my takeaway from it.
I think it's great. And you know, calories in, calories out, or CICO, KICO, whatever you want to call it, the math is true. I think it's a good starting point. The one layer of paint I would add on top is that not all calories are the same.
Yeah.
So if you could have 1800 calories a day of Pepsi, right? But you're not going to feel good. Like, you're still answering, you're still figuring out the same, hey, I'm having 1800 calories and I'm burning 3000, and like A minus B is a negative number, so I'll be at a calorie deficit. Like, it's true, but then, okay, not all calories are the same. A really key factor is that certain calories are more satiating than others. So 100 calories of eggs is more satiating than 100 calories of a Snickers bar.
Yeah.
So
I think everyone who's listening can think of like two things that you love to eat. Or there's the other idea of like a domino food, where one is satiating, but the second part is like you can just keep eating it. So for me, that's like pasta. Like, I love pasta. I could eat it 7 times a day. And for a lot of people, they can eat pasta and just be completely fine. But for me, it's like, I will just keep eating the full thing. Like, if there's more, I could just keep eating it. So didn't mean to interrupt you, but go on.
That's what the keto diet proponents really like, is that if you're eating stuff on the keto diet, it's all high in fat, high in protein. That satiates you really well. Like, if you said, hey, eat as much as you want today, but it's only eggs, avocado, steak, salmon, it's only like, you can't eat, I don't know, like,
it's difficult to overeat.
You open a bag of potato chips, crisps, whatever, it's so easy to get addicted. You just wolf down the whole thing. Like, I've never eaten
like Pringles. They literally do what they say on the tin. Like, you'll keep going until that,
yeah,
the
once
whole
you, once you pop
tin's
you
gone.
I've never seen someone who sits down and they just like can't stop eating eggs. You know, you sit down and you eat eggs, you eat like 3, 4, 5 if you're really hungry. I've never seen someone sit down and just like, oh man, I gotta get another one. Let me get another. I gotta clear out
completely.
This whole carton. But we are that way with cookies. We are that way with crisps. Like, we are that way across all of these highly, and what's in common of all those is a very highly processed carbohydrates. They spike your blood glucose, which spikes your blood insulin. The glucose goes away, but the high insulin is there. And then that's telling our brain, hey, you need more. You need more. We just turn on this addiction treadmill that just does not happen when you're eating other types of
satiating food. Yeah, completely.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this really interesting study, for instance, on our product with ketones, where if you have 100 calories of ketones versus 100 calories of sugar, they did the objective reading of ghrelin, which is the hunger hormone, and they showed that people had suppressed ghrelin from the ketones. And then separately, people were double blinded. They didn't know what they had had or not. It was all flavor controlled. And when they were asked, how hungry are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Again, the group that had had the same amount of calories, but it was from ketones, felt less hungry than those who'd had the same amount of calories from sugar. So calories in, calories out is correct, but incomplete. And a way to make it maybe more complete, if calories in, calories out covers like, it's like 70%, than saying, hey, not all calories are the same and some are more satiating. I think that gets you to like 90%.
90%, yeah.
If you want the rest, you know, listen to the whole podcast, go subscribe to, you know, everyone, but it's diminishing returns at that point. But I would say your rule of thumb is off of those two.
That's a good point, because for most people, that's all they should and want to know, right? But like for the hardcore people like us who really want to understand the details and like make the most of the things because we're curious about it, I think it's interesting to explore. So I just saw you take a sip of the ketones there, right? So could you explain a little bit about like why people like yourself and I think you said, was it 60% of people doing Tour de France? Is that right?
Yeah.
60% doing Tour de France, which is, you know, notoriously one of the hardest, you know, athletic feats, right? Like how many hours does a Tour de France take, by the way? Is it?
It's 3 weeks, 21 days of biking every single day. And it is one of the hardest in terms of just overall raw output. Like the NBA finals is hard, but for different reasons. Like in terms of just overall raw output, Tour de France is the hardest.
Got it. Yeah, complete.
It's stages. It's actually really fascinating. I think a lot of people know about the Tour de France, and like it's really interesting. Basically, a quick primer on how it works. Fun fact is that you get it every day you race, and every day there's you're X minutes behind the person in first place, and you basically tally that up over time, and then whoever has the lowest time at the end wins. So the guy who won this year, he actually only won on one of the days, but he was always kind of in the top five. And so he didn't accrue a lot of like time below par, so to speak. And so then by the time it wraps up, he was in first. And then you have all these side awards, like fastest on this one special mountain, you get a special jersey. It's kind of this weird European,
yeah.
No offense to Europeans. It's kind of this like weird, like there's a lot of like sideshows and tradition and provenance to the
got it. And so there. Could you explain why someone I think I get it, but yeah. Just why specifically Tour de France? Like why they finding success in using something like this?
Well, when you look at a sport like basketball or soccer, you see a lot of variables to it where you care about stamina, but you also care about field IQ and ball control and team chemistry. Like there's a lot of other aspects. Versus when you look at these pure play endurance sports, all you care about on the bike is stamina. There's not a lot else. It's pretty monodimensional. And so when you zoom into that, it really fractals out. It's like, okay, well, how do I shave every gram of weight off of my bike? How do I myself shave every gram? I don't want to carry extra body fat up the mountain. But if I shave off too much body fat, then I'm not going to have enough to fuel me for 21 days of insane level of biking. So they're very dialed in on their nutrition, on their stamina. So it's a natural test bed for any kind of high performance nutrition. Same with marathoning. It's just so like singular focused. So that's why it started there. The way they use it again is that mix. So they'll have carbs and ketones. They are not trying to do a ketogenic diet. They are looking at ketones specifically as a super fuel, and they'll mix it in their water bottle with carbs. And again, it's that dynamic of you can only eat so many carbs so fast before you get a traffic jam. You can only process so much at a time. If you have another source that's going through another highway into your system, through your stomach, into your mitochondria and your cells, and then it's additive in a way that simply having, you know, another banana, like a fourth banana, is not going to help you as much as saying having a couple of bananas and then some ketones. So that's how Tour de France athletes are using it.
And so
they're also using it a little bit more just like on recovery. Like if you have it after your race with your protein and your post-workout meal, carbs, protein, it accelerates the uptake of your recovery nutrition.
Yeah. So this episode is sponsored by Just Works. Just Works makes it easier for you to start, run, and grow a business. Let me tell you how Just Works can help your business. Running and scaling a business is easier when you have the right tools in place. Just Works gives you the peace of mind in knowing that payroll will run smoothly, your team has access to high quality benefits, and your business is getting the support it needs. Just Works makes it simple to hire and manage remote employees across all 50 states. That's a cloud-based platform that enables managers and employees alike to quickly and securely access benefits, payroll and other HR functionality from anywhere, an intuitive self-service user experience that makes admin easier for your whole team, help when you need it with 24/7 expert support for you and your employees, access to certified HR consultants who can provide tailored guidance and best practices around managing your people, transparent pricing with no hidden costs so you always know exactly what you're paying for. Run your business with confidence. Take a look at JustWorks transparent pricing by visiting justworks.com/pricing. That's justworks.com/pricing for details. Now let's get straight back to the show. Got it. And so, and I think you alluded to it there, like basketball versus cycling. Like one is pure endurance, like how long can you stay on this bike and keep pedaling for a long period of time, versus like when you say basketball, I think of like explosive, you know, like speed, like you're accelerating very quickly for short bursts. Yeah. And I don't know if there's a difference between, you know, like let's say ketones as a fuel source for that sort of exercise, because, and again, this is like fuzzy Joe Rogan pods from like 5 years ago in my head here, but yeah. I think I remember like the phrase like glycogen or something being in like your muscles. So like when you're lifting weights, you deplete your glycogen, I think.
Right.
And that is more like the short term kind of like pump that you're getting. Is that roughly right, or am I confusing things here?
No, that's totally right. That basically glycogen is just stored glucose.
It's not like this other thing.
Glycogen is stored blood sugar in your muscles. It's in your liver. It's stored as glycogen. So when it gets re-released in your bloodstream, it's glucose. Talking about all the same thing there.
Yeah. But
yeah.
Okay.
That is basically like your more snappy. Like if you got to go run around a track, you won't even have enough time for your like fat and ketone system to kick in. Anything really sub an hour. That is the kind of the line where it leads over into endurance, where you're going to really want to be able to use your own onboard fat, create your own ketones, start drinking ketones for like longer endurance. But yeah, for that quick snappy stuff, it's very
glucose heavy. It's normally, because I think when I'd looked at originally the keto diet specifically, that's kind of when I'd done this research around ketones as a fuel source. And I remember like athletes saying, okay, well, if you're, you know, sprinter, like you said, or you're, you know, something that is about like short, fast bursts, it's very unlikely you want to be just strictly on a keto diet, for example, because like you need the glucose most of the time to be optimal. So that kind of brings me on to that topic, because I know in your you know we talked about keto a few times there, and the question is like, why should someone use an external source versus just fasting or, you know, doing this through food? And I think we kind of got to a bit of an answer. Maybe it's just like it's easier to tap into this energy source, but is there anything else I'm missing there?
It's just that it's a good source of energy, where if you're doing the keto diet, you're eating something. You're eating bulletproof coffee is really popular, where you take coffee and you add butter or MCT or coconut oil. MCT stands for medium chain triglyceride. It's a form of fat that relatively easily converts into ketones. We just skip the step where we have straight ketones. So any calories that you're eating are adding calories to your system. If all you want to do is lose weight, you just fast, right? Like then you will, for sure, all of your calories that you're burning will be your own body fat. And I mean, you'll be burning some muscle as well, as you mentioned earlier. But that basically, if your goal is to lose weight, it's like, just don't eat. As soon as you start adding calories into the system, which is totally natural and you should do, like I don't recommend just strict fasting. Like, as soon as you're adding calories into the system, you're shifting that energy balance where you have some calories coming in and then you got to burn those, and then hopefully also burn some onboard body fat if your goal is weight loss. So you want to eat, but not too much. The point being that if you're doing keto diet, like you're eating something. And so what you don't want to eat is sugary, carby stuff. You want to eat things that are more lower carb, and ketone IQ is just the pure form. I wouldn't say that's just the only thing someone should eat. It's more just like alongside your bulletproof coffee, you take a sip of ketone IQ. Or I don't do full keto diet. I'm a big marathon runner. I eat carbs. I have a mixed diet, and I will sip on ketone IQ like I am right now, my fine tequila glass.
Yeah.
And it, to me, it's just, hey, there's no caffeine in it and there's no sugar in it. And it's just a healthy source of energy. Like, I feel very dialed in. That same feeling you get when you're fasting or eating low carb, when you're just really dialed in, I feel that way a lot of times, you know, when you run a lot. So if I go on a 15-mile run, when I come back, if I do the blood finger prick, I'll have elevated ketones because I've drawn low on blood glucose. I'll have elevated ketones. So a lot of people like it who are doing the keto diet for those reasons, but a lot of people like Ketone IQ when they're not doing the keto diet at all, because it's just a source of energy. It's a, yeah, it's a way to get a nice pick me up that feels like you've
it's
been fasting.
It's more about the feeling. Yeah. It's that feeling, right? So, and so the question I have for you is, like, on the flip side, if you were not you with your company and the person who is arguing against this case for using ketones, exogenous ketones, what is the best, like, argument for not using this? And there, and you can then obviously, you know, say why you think that's incorrect, but I'm just curious, like, you've obviously been in this space for a while, you've had plenty of people, I'm sure, arguing with you and saying,
yeah,
this is, like, unnecessary, or, like, what are the negative parts of doing this for some people?
Yeah, you would say that you don't need it, just let your body make its own ketones.
Got it. Okay. And what would be your rebuttal to that?
My rebuttal to that would be, anything that you're putting into your system is adding calories. And why are you eating MCTs? Why are you eating avocado? Like, why are you eating anything with the hopes that it will turn into ketones and fuel your brain and your muscles? You need some calories from something. And yes, create them endogenously from your own fat, create them from nutrition that you're eating and turning into ketones. And it's another helpful tool in the toolkit to have a pure ketone drink. It doesn't, yeah, it, like, negate the other
things that you're doing.
It's just like, hey, you're feeling a little energy lull at 2 p.m. Do you want to eat an avocado and wait for it to turn into ketones?
Okay,
or do you want to,
yeah,
feel good right now? Like, you want a Kit Kat bar, you want a, you know, Coca-Cola, like, okay, the pitch would be like, have a shot of Ketone IQ and keep on your low carb or keto diet and have a nice day.
Yeah,
with it.
That makes sense. Okay. And so that is all we talked about, the sports implications. We talked a little bit about the army stuff earlier, but I'm curious, because are you allowed to say the dollar amount contract? I have it here in my notes, but I wasn't sure if that was externally, yeah, safe.
Yeah, and so it's all good. It's American taxpayer money, so it's, yeah, public record. It's on some .gov sites out there. It's in 2019 we got a $6 million contract with Special Operations Command to look at exogenous ketones for soldier performance in different cognitively and physically demanding states. So they're really interested in target practice, stamina, target practice when you're exhausted. They're really interested in hypoxia. That's a major area we look at. So low oxygen. Hypoxia just means low oxygen. So at altitude or deep sea diving or fighter pilots, ketones have really interesting effects in those contexts. So
got it.
And so major thrust there.
And so that is mostly research based, right? At the moment, it's not necessarily, is it like actively people in the army are using this at the moment, or is it just more of a research phase?
It's research phase. It's research phase where we are doing kind of science around how applications where it can be used, putting together the protocols and getting the findings. So it's actually wrapping up. Like, it's been going on for a few years and we're doing our final findings. Like, we have preliminary results already, very positive, and then we're doing our final findings kind of end of this year into early next year. So, and then from there it rolls into procurement. It's like, hey, if this is actually good for hypoxia, good for traumatic brain injury, then it becomes a procurement item and it's in the field of use for special operators, and then from there flowing into just general everyone.
Awesome. Yeah, that's very interesting. So the other kind of area I was curious to get your take on was, we've kind of alluded to nutrition, your own personal approach to it. I think you just said earlier you don't have a full keto diet, you have, you know, more of a mixed approach, which makes a lot of sense for probably most people, and especially for someone like yourself who's doing marathons. I know you've done, like, I think you do triathlons and stuff as well.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, from all of the stuff you've read and experienced and spoken to all these people in this space, like, where do you land as an individual? And extending that, like, from your understanding, are there certain things that probably are useful to most people?
Yeah. My mindset on it is you want to clear out the carbs that you eat. So if you're an active person, you're going to do that pretty quickly and easily, and you might actually need to eat more carbs. If you're running every day, like when I'm in peak marathoning, I'm running 70 miles a week, I can't eat enough. Like I need to eat more so I have enough energy to go do it again the next day. Champagne problems. But that basically, like when I'm in more like normal mode, like I'm still active, I'm still doing something active every day, running, lifting, whatnot. I like to do something active every day. My point is to clear out my carbohydrates. It is not good, and the levels, folks will tell you this, and just general science will tell you this, like what you do not want to have is just like ongoing ambient high blood sugar. That is how you get diabetes. It's how you just end up low energy in general. Short term, it's bad. You're going to feel bad. Long term, it's not good for your health. So my mission is to clear out, get to a low blood sugar level every day. I don't do a full keto diet because I'm not saying like my goal is to constantly be at like absolute basement blood sugar levels, which is what the keto diet gets you.
Yeah.
My mission is like go in and out of ketosis throughout the week, like get into ketosis more than zero, like get into ketosis a couple few times a week, just by virtue of not eating a ton of carbs to begin with, being active and clearing out the carbs that I do eat. So it's not the biggest sin. It's like let me bring this down to planet Earth, which is that I'll wake up and go for a run and won't have anything carby for breakfast or lunch. And then maybe at dinner, I don't know, dinner, I kind of let loose, have whatever, you have some pizza, have some this, some that. And then I'm fasting overnight. Next morning I go for a run. Like when I get back from that run, I haven't had that much carbs in the prior 24 days. I just ran 7 miles. I do a blood finger prick.
So did you mean 24 hours? You just said 24 days. Just making sure.
Sorry. Yeah. I haven't had that much hours, in the last, in the last 24 days, I haven't had that accrued that much. And then when I go for a run again, I clear it all out. So after my run, I'm already like getting back into elevated ketone levels. So I'm not hardline about it. Like I don't have an issue with having fruit, pasta for dinner. I try to backload the carbs like to later in the day. So because I like feeling really sharp throughout the day.
Yeah.
And so what I'm trying to do is like have like relatively little, but I'm not a completely dogmatic about it. I try to have like less carbs in the standard diet. I don't really touch like candy and sweets. And if I'm having carbs, it's like around a meal, and then I'm doing something active where I'm clearing it out and getting, you want to hit the bottom of your carb tank, I would say, on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And then if you're really dogmatic.
So when you say, sorry to cut you off there, but when you say clear it out, you mean use those up, right? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Use those up to where if you're wearing a levels or you're wearing a continuous glucose monitor, like get down to a low resting blood glucose on a regular basis. And does that mean, again, I guess the point there is, it's not to say like never eat carbs. My lens and having talked to all these people and understanding of nutrition is you don't want constant high blood sugar. You want to hit that bottom on a regular basis. You want to give your body a chance to make its own ketones, be using ketones, having ketones in your system on a regular basis.
But then still metabolizing carbs, and because that's the other side to this, which I think, you know, if you were saying the bad side to a pure keto diet, like obviously you're like a runner and you're active, but like from your point of view, is there a lot of like negative stuff on that side that people might not always be thinking about? Like, for example, if someone was in ketosis for, I think you said earlier, like 60 days or something was a number you said at one point. I think like being in that state, you're doing keto more of diet. A short-term thing. Yeah. Let's say someone did it for 6 months. From your understanding, would there be like a lot of negative effects of being in that low blood sugar state for too long a period? Could that do like damage to you as well?
Your body will find a basement. You're never going to go to like zero because your body, you have other ways of making sugar.
It needs some sort of sugar, right? Yeah, that's a good point.
It needs some baseline level. So you'll make it from proteins, you can turn proteins actually into sugar. It's called gluconeogenesis. Your body can do that. So you'll keep some basement level of carbs going. But no, to answer your question, if you're doing keto for an extended period, if you feel good, I think you're good. Like, if what happens with a lot of people is that they don't feel good, and that
they just keep doing it for another reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's very hard to comply with. And, but then other people swear by it and they got started for weight loss and now they just stick to it, and it's way easier for them to just stick, and they have all these amazing recipes and they figured out how to make the keto version of pancakes and the keto version of this and that. And they love it. What I see a lot of people do is they do it for a stretch. It works to a degree, but it's kind of unsustainable for, it's hard to go out and eat. It's hard to have, you can never have a beer.
It's not very social. Yeah. It becomes a lot. I've done it for a decent amount of time before. And so the way I'm right now is like, I have done it actually like a month or two ago. I did it closer to that, but similar to you, I like adapt it. Like, I'm not like super crazy about it. I'm just like, where a lot of it kind of naturally happens if you're eating kind of like good, if you're just having like good protein and salad and vegetables, a lot of that by nature of the fact you're putting olive oil in, like the macros kind of end up being close to that anyway. Yeah. But then like still not being so crazy, like you can have some rice, you can have some pasta, like mix it in. But I feel like that's a long way away from the generic, you know, standard American diet, which is like, that is the base layer of the pyramid, right? Like, you know, have Frosties for breakfast and bread. And then, so my lens has become more so about like high, nutritionally dense sort of food. So like, where am I getting good nutrition from? Mostly again, from like good quality vegetables, salad, good proteins. That's kind of how some fruit as well. So yeah, it sounds like very simple, but like, I think when you cut out a lot of the bread and the stuff that you'd have at every meal, like you can still then afford to have it, you know, once a day versus three times a day.
I think that's right. And what you're describing is similar to Whole30 or even paleo, or doing that type of diet, you end up basically going 2/3 of the way towards keto, because you're not having Pringles, you're not having Frosted Flakes, you're not having these highly processed carbs. So you end up, if you have some carrots, the hardline keto people will be like, no, there's sugar inside of carrots. But like, no one ever got fat eating carrots. You know what I mean? Like,
that's true. Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And also, honestly, the fruit thing for me is another one. Like, I pretty much have fruit every day, but I pretty much have like berries. That's mostly the fruit I have. And again, that's not, like, if someone wants a banana and they want apples, like, they should do that. But for me personally, it's one of those things where I could easily just like have, like, my whole meal could be fruits, like, because they're delicious, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not that I don't have too much of them. It's more like I'm having other stuff that gives me a lot of the good stuff anyway. But then I'll have the fruit when I want to have it. So it's not like a crazy, like, you should not have fruit, because that's ridiculous. Like, fruit is mostly good for you. So, but I think it's coming from another angle where people, like, when you're going from a standard American diet to, oh, I'm going to eat healthy in air quotes, and then you're having like orange juice for breakfast, which is different to having like a piece of fruit.
So
that's
you've
like,
stripped away a lot of the fiber. You've just taken the fiber out. Yeah.
It's a big like shot of sugar essentially. So yeah. So anyway, we could get in, talk about it for hours, so we can move on from that. But thanks for sharing your side of things. Another thing you mentioned a little bit earlier was a 7-day fast. So fasting, intermittent fasting, whatever you want to call it, is a very hot topic for the last few years. But like you said, it's a bit of an ancient tradition. I'm Muslim. I think you're Jewish probably, right? I think you said in the past. So like you said, well, I think you mentioned it before, and I'm Muslim. And so like, yeah, we have 30 days of Ramadan, right? Like, we do that of Ramadan. So we do it every day from sunrise to sunset. You don't eat. So I grew up doing that. I don't do it as much anymore, but I basically intermittent fast most, you know, like a few days a week at least, if not most of the week. But more so, it's essentially skipping breakfast and eating lunch a little bit later. That's kind of what works for me. But there's different types of fasts. There's also this 3-day or 7-day or even longer fast. So could you tell me a bit about your experience of doing a 7-day fast and what the theory is around doing that longer fasted state?
Yeah. A lot of people have gotten into some sort of intermittent fast, skipping breakfast, or 16 and 8, where you're fasting for 16 hours and eating within 8 hours, or OMAD, one meal a day, where you just stack all your calories within one meal. That's generally called intermittent fasting. If you're eating within a day, you're not going more than 24 hours, it's intermittent fasting. Beyond that, it starts being called extended fasting. And I've been off and on with the extended fasting of like doing 36 hours or like, you know, fasting on Monday, basically have dinner Sunday and then don't eat again until Tuesday. So it ends up being like 8 p.m. until blackout the next day, and then 8 a.m. the following day you have breakfast. I've done that off and on. I'm not doing it right now because I'm running relatively a lot. And again, it's going back to the...
What works for you? Yeah.
What works for you? And I'm trying to burn what I'm eating. And if I'm burning a lot, I actually need to eat more. And so I'm not trying to... Like, I'd rather not feel like shit on my run. And if I'm eating more is going to make me feel better for that, then I do that. But if I'm in a less active period, or I'm sometimes when work gets really busy, or if I'm traveling and I can't exercise as much as I want, I actually will do more fasting, because I'll just notice, hey, look, like if I go from running 7 miles a day to I'm just sitting on airplanes for 3 days straight, I end up just falling into some intermittent fasting.
Because you're also just like not using as much energy, right? You're just sitting versus walking around and running or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Extended fasting. So I've played around with a lot of, I've done carnivore diet, extended fast, done a lot of interesting different things just to see what happens. Extended fast is interesting. I think it's very, some people love the health benefits. I think a lot of people actually get into kind of spiritual or mental benefits where you just feel very
like a meditative state almost.
Yeah. You just become like, you don't have time for bullshit. You don't have extra calories to spend.
Yeah, that's quite a funny way to put it. Yeah.
And you're just very like, you're vibrating at a different wavelength. There's health benefits for people. A lot of people, they find that it actually helps them snap back to a more healthy diet afterwards, where if you're just on a bender,
like a reset.
Like you have a bachelor party, stag party, like you summer, whatever, you have a period in your life, maybe around the holidays.
No, you went rules. To Burning Man, you came back. Or something like that. Yeah,
exactly. You have this period of opulence, all good, and you come back from it. Some people have a easier time fasting for a day or two or three, because then when you come back from it, what's happened is that you've gained a lot of sensitivity. And if you go and have something with a little sugar in it, you feel it. You feel it's electric. And then you're not, if you go from a fast and then you eat like a Reese's peanut butter cup, you will feel like you're in an electric chair. You will feel itchy from the inside out. Yeah. If anyone's ever done it, like, which is a good thing. Like, you basically reset the volume. It's like if you go into a silent chamber for 36 hours and you come back, you could listen to like this quietest Mozart symphony and it would make you shed a tear. You know what I mean?
I love that kind of visual, actually, because it's also like there's another sort of fast people talk about nowadays is dopamine fast, right? Where we're constantly being hit on social media and like, you know, everything else around the stimulants that we're all addicted to, essentially, of dopamine hits. And like being fasted from that, you go back to opening up Instagram and being like, oh, now I feel like you're even more sensitive to it after having a break, I think. So, yeah. But just before we skip ahead, the idea of doing a 3 or 7 day fast, and again, I might be using the wrong word here, so correct me if I'm wrong. Is there a word called autophagy? Is that the right word here? Is this relevant?
Yeah. So yeah, what your body is basically
repairing itself or something, right? So
autophagy.
No,
sorry about that. Yeah, I think the question is what is autophagy, or what happens when you're fasting?
Yeah, and how does it relate to fasting? Yeah.
Yeah. Autophagy is this process where your body basically consumes itself, but you're consuming the waste products. You're consuming, there's certain protein buildups that are unhelpful. A lot of people swear by it. Or it's like, oh, my scar tissue reduced, or this pain I was feeling in my knee. Like there was some buildup there from a prior incident that there's this autophagy that takes place because you're fasting, your body is scrounging calories from everywhere. Your body is smart. It's not going to start digesting like mission critical tissues. It's going to be digesting the least important tissues. So autophagy happens when you're fasting. There's that natural kind of cleanup process.
That's the word I was thinking. Cleanup is probably the word I was thinking of. Is it like a certain period of time you need to generally wait. Obviously, I'm sure it varies because it depends how much that person's eaten slash how active they've been. But let's say they get to a point where their most of their glucose stores have been used, essentially.
Yeah.
Is that when they start getting into that autophagy moment, essentially? Or am I just putting two and two together there?
No, it's about right. It's at that like 24-hour period where your body is starting to scrounge.
Got it. Okay.
One way to think about helpful like reference numbers is that your body can store about 2,000 calories of sugar or carbs. So if you do, that's about a day's worth of energy.
Oh,
that
got
you can
it. Okay. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then, and so you kind of have this battery that will last for a day, and then it hits empty, and then you have 100 times more calories stored as fat. Even on a lean individual, you have 200,000 calories of fat stored. So you can think, I don't know if this is a helpful analogy or too nerdy, it's like RAM versus hard drive.
Yeah, that's a good point. I like that. Short-term memory versus long-term stored memory.
It's like short and quick, because remember, like for sprinting, you want the carbs, glucose, sugar. Like it's short, quick, low storage versus hard drive. It takes a minute to turn fat into usable energy, but you can store a lot more of it, and it's going to help you more on like endurance and on long fasts.
Got it. And so when you did a 7-day fast, were you literally having zero calories? You're just having water, or were you having other stuff as well?
Yeah, just water. I wasn't even drinking ketones. It's just pure water.
Tea or anything like that?
I think I had a little bit, of caffeine, like a little. I'd have like some tea.
Yeah.
And it was cool. I mean, look, it honestly plateaued. Like it didn't get any different after like day two. It's just kind of the same.
Really?
And,
okay.
Yeah, I didn't get super duper hungry. It's like you kind of get hungry, you get through the clear. I think the first day is, in a way, it's the hardest because your body's like ramping up its own production of ketones and its own ability to utilize those ketones. And once the kind of machine gets going, once the hard drive gets whirring, then you're good to go. It's not like it's walk in the park, but it's interesting how your body reacts to it. You don't feel like constantly hungry. It kind of comes and goes. And then I think your body just eventually settles. It's like, okay, well, guess there's no food. Like
do you know what the world record is for like how long a body can actually last? Like I think it's quite a lot longer than 7 days in terms of without food. Obviously, water is different.
There's this Harvard 40 days study. Or something? There's this Harvard study. This clinically obese man that fasted for a year and didn't die.
A year? That is wild. That is insane.
But normally it's like what's the rule of thumb? It's 30 days without food, 3 days without water, 3 minutes without air.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know that, but that's good to know. And so, and the other thing I'd say from, well, first of all, we won't have time to go into all of this in the next 10 minutes, which we only got 10 minutes left. If you're more interested in this area, there's a guy called Peter Attia, which he's got a lot of really good stuff on fasting on his blog and his podcast, The Drive. And there's probably some other people I'm forgetting. Is it Walter Longo? Does he do stuff on this as well? So he's got some good stuff on this. But I would say there's an app called Zero, which I use, which essentially is like a fasting timer app. Like you can basically just say I've started fasting and ended fasting, which is just a nice little thing to have. But more importantly, inside that app, they have a bunch of like learning stuff. So if you want to see lectures and them talking about why fast, different types of fasting, the benefits, all the autophagy stuff we were talking about, a lot of that I probably learned there. And the podcast of Peter T I've really liked. And I would say you're someone who's like already experimenting and it probably lives a pretty healthy lifestyle. I'd say someone going from like a standard American diet where their blood sugar levels are elevated most of the time, going to something like this is probably going to be a lot harder for someone to just go straight into a long fast, from my understanding. And then the other thing I've noticed when I've done longer fasts, I've never done like a 7-day one, is electrolytes. So like that's quite important, because for a lot of people, even when you're eating kind of like low carb, like you, people like in keto, there's a thing called keto flu. I don't know if you've experienced that before, but essentially when you're not having enough electrolytes, you can start feeling like you get a headache and you start feeling dizzy and stuff like that. And a lot of the time that is because you haven't had enough electrolytes. So I'm curious, did you have to supplement with any electrolytes when you did the fast?
I personally did. I had some salts and some, yeah, some electrolyte powders in my drinks.
Perfect.
It's you're right on the money that a lot of times when people hit a wall with a low carb keto diet, water, electrolytes, it really helps get them back on course.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. So that was the fast. Now to close us out here, I know you're like really on the cutting edge of all this stuff. I'm going to say a few kind of buzzwords here, wearables, like this whole area of biohacking, essentially, whether that's wearables like the Oura Ring or the levels that we've talked about before, microdosing, the quantified self movement. Like, I'm curious if any of those resonate with you and you're like, if I said the lens of the most interesting stuff you're seeing in the space of what people are now experimenting with, I'd say like the CGM continuous glucose monitor, like 5 to 7 years ago, was completely brand new to me. And I was like, wow, that is crazy. Someone's doing that, putting a device to figure this stuff out. What are some of those newer things? Like maybe microdosing might be an area to kind of touch on, but I'm curious what stands out for you right now.
Yeah, there's a few. One that's popped up recently and that I've actually done, or my family has done, is stem cell preservation. I had a daughter, she's 7 months old, and when she was born, the umbilical cord and placenta have the stem cell of the newborn inside of it. And stem cells are really interesting, right? Because they can, in principle, they can go to any other type of cell. Like a stem cell can become a spinal cord cell, a knee meniscus cell, and skin cell, right? So
wow.
We have a current level of understanding what stem cells can do and what diseases they can address. But I looked at this very much with a like finance lens, where unbounded upside, like there is possible within my daughter's lifetime, she lives to be, I don't know, 60, 70, 80 years old, that is unbounded upside of what we're going to discover at the rate of scientific discovery of what a stem cell could do. When I'm 70, I will wish I had my own stem cells. So, and that's super interesting. Where right now there's like X amount of value. It was kind of like a on the fence decision, but that it's kind of like investing in a startup. It's like, this could be the next Uber, or this stem cell thing could be the next, this could be life saving if you get cancer and you're 40 and you have access to your own stem cells. A lot of these therapies involve stem cells, but you're trying to like get a stem cell match from another person or from a synthetic source. And that's one thing I thought was super interesting. We worked with a company called Anja Health, and that's something I've been hearing a good amount about is
wow. Yeah, that's super interesting. I haven't really dug into that. And so just so I understand, are they taking like a stem cell from her, you're saying, or is it like a family? You said family, so I wasn't sure if it's related to you guys.
Well, it was something, not something, I just said family is like not literally mine. It was, I guess, my wife and my daughter, like the placenta and umbilical cord are in a refrigerator somewhere.
Wow.
That is what it is.
That's wild. That is insane. So, okay, that is definitely something I need to dig into a bit more. What about microdosing? Is that something you've looked at a little bit?
Microdosing is super interesting, and it actually stacks really well with ketone IQ, because a lot of these ancient practices of doing any kind of dosing, like ayahuasca ceremonies, a lot of times there's like this fasting and purging state beforehand where you get into ketosis, right? Everything we've been talking about, you're fasting, and then you go and do ayahuasca in a hut in Brazil for a day. So there seems to be this priming effect of when you have ketones in your system, your brain is running on ketones to then apply a psychoactive, that like basically psychoactives increase brain activity, but they generally don't have energy inside of them. Like ayahuasca, psilocybin from magic mushrooms, LSD, even caffeine, like these are all psychoactive compounds, but
ketamine be in this?
Ketamine,
bracket as well, okay.
And we'll talk about that in a sec. Like, so those are all psychoactives, but that increase brain activity, which increases brain energy demand, But then that begs the question about, okay, where is the energy coming from? And there's something about ketones that it's kind of this lock and key fit where being in ketosis when you're doing psychoactives tends to potentiate the effect of those psychoactives. So ketamine is super interesting. I know here in LA, there's like many ketamine clinics where it's kind of where medicinal cannabis was at like 5-10 years ago, where you kind of, you go in, a doctor asks you, hey, Bilal, are you having trouble sleeping? Are you having trouble?
Oh, right. Yeah. Like the special, it's like when people have the emotional support animal certificate for their dog,
right?
Or whatever. Yeah. So,
it's one of those things where, dog is not
with you, right? Yeah, exactly. So, and just so, again, we might need to do a part two for this stuff and bring someone else on as well, who's like really deep into the microdosing stuff. But, and I'm curious because a lot of people who listen to this who don't know anything about it have heard the word magic mushrooms, LSD, and what did I just say? The horse tranquilizer. What was it called? Ketamine. And they have associated it with something 20 years ago that they saw in a rave and they were like scared of, right? And to be honest, I haven't done any of those personally, though I'm not against doing that at some point when I learn more about it. But I think the idea of microdosing is that you're not necessarily getting that full psychoactive, like trippy thing that you might get from like mushrooms or something.
We can microdose mushrooms too.
You can microdose mushrooms, and I know actually quite a lot of people who are doing that, and there's research now that has been done and clinical trials, I believe, on people with PTSD, people like fought in wars, people who are clinically depressed, and seeing like if this microdosing can like help raise essentially that kind of like baseline, and like whether that's like anxiety, if you, everyone's felt anxious a little bit, but imagine that feeling all day, like being kind of on edge. Is there a way to like bring that baseline up? Which again, talking to people who've done like proper psychoactive stuff, a lot of them will say like, oh my God, it was like life changing. And, you know, there's also people who have terrible trips and a bad, you know, changes them in a really negative way. But a lot of them say like, oh, I'm just a happier person, or like, it just took me up like a notch, you know? So I'm actually really curious to see more about that world.
Have you heard of stoned ape theory?
No. What does that mean?
There's this period of rapid human brain expansion, or when we were evolving from like pre-human advanced apes to humans, and fossil evidence on that seems to indicate that we were very nomadic. We were doing a lot of endurance hunting, walking around all day, and we were also eating a lot of magic mushrooms. And it's really interesting when you think of having mushrooms today. You have this kind of like mind-blasting experience, I've heard, where you're kind of like on this other dimension. It's interesting to think that the first human experience was actually an ape eating mushrooms and having these like first human moments of like looking at their own hand. Oh my God, you have a hand. Is the way that you think about your hand the way I think about my hand? How do I express this? And then the first like symbolic systems of language and abstractions and empathy and like building blocks of civilization started happening when these advanced apes were getting exposed. And then it was kind of generational, where it was like epigenetic, where you have it, you have some leapfrog advance, and then you pass that to the next generation, but then they're also exposed to the same stimuli in their environment. And that it was a very small, it's like 40,000 years of history, which is a blink in evolutionary context. But in that period of time, brain size expanded and we basically like became a civilized species, and maybe probably we're also exposed to a lot of psychedelics in that time. So it's interesting because there's a lot of like this new conversation around it of 2022, is it getting deregulated? Is it going to follow it? But back before there was all these three letter agencies that made everything illegal, like humans, I think we're just doing a lot of this stuff. So,
yeah, fair. Yeah,
no, it's other topic to go into there, but
That's complete. We'll have to do a part two, but that's definitely a really interesting idea of like the cultural shift that's happened, right? And I think like one of my earliest episodes on here was with Joe Dolce, I think his name was. If you're interested in like regulation in weed and you know, like marijuana stuff, like, we did that like 5 years ago plus, and like to see that some of the stuff that's now happening, even at literally Joe Biden's level. You know, and like the stigma of, you know, marijuana and changing so much, even just in the last like 5-6 years, I think we're going to probably have that in like the next 10 years with a lot of this psychedelic stuff. And I think in like the coastal cities like New York, LA, San Francisco, like a lot of us are already used to people, you know, doing a lot of this stuff, and like even like older people experimenting. It's not just like young people at parties, is kind of what I'm saying. Whereas I'd say like for a lot of the world and maybe the other parts of the country, it's not as, maybe I'm like generalizing here, but like maybe it's not as like prevalent as it is, say, like in LA. I think LA specifically is like probably the most advanced in this sort of stuff, usually. So yeah, really interesting area to see the developments there.
Yeah. Also, people drink a lot of alcohol everywhere, and I think it's
the
question always gets asked. I don't know, you look at the map of the United States, I think Wisconsin has the highest amount of alcohol. Like, what's so special about alcohol? Like, what's so special about ethanol? It's pretty bad for you. You get drunk, it has an effect, shifts you into a different mind state. Like, okay, like why can't we take an objective look at other compounds that shift you into a different mind state and maybe have less of a side effect profile? And maybe the mind state shift is more productive. You can't drink and drive. A lot of people drink and do abusive things. Like, it's, alcohol's not great.
Yeah, it's not
somehow
great.
That's like, why have we chosen
culturally,
that?
You're right. It's a cultural thing, I think, where we've just accepted, and like in many places, like celebrate like the negative side effects. And I'm English, so I completely get it, right? Like during the Euros, like last year, in the final of the Euro final in Wembley, the stuff people were doing there in England that the WhatsApp groups were sending around was absolutely ridiculous stuff. But you know, culturally, English people are like, oh yeah, that's funny, and you know, whatever. And look, I'm the same, right? I found it funny too. But when I take a step back and think, like, why are we celebrating a guy being upside down drinking right now? Like the same way at a college party in America, like people are upside down drinking from like a keg or whatever, or like hitting a bong or whatever. Like, it's just these weird cultural things we've done over the years. And you're right, like we should kind of like take that assumption away and say, why are we so okay with one thing and like completely crazy no to another? And a lot of the time it ends up being somewhere in between where it should really land. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves over the next kind of 10 years, I think.
Yeah, really interesting thread. We could go on
definitely
for a while there.
Well, let's definitely save it for the next time, man, because I know we've already gone a few minutes over the scheduled time. But I really appreciate you coming on. Where can people go and check out all the products you talked about? Obviously, this is your pitch segment, so you can tell people where to go learn more about what you guys do.
Yeah, thanks everyone for listening in. We have our own podcast, the HVMN podcast. Our research lead, he has a PhD in cardiac metabolism from Oxford. He goes into all sorts of interesting conversations with different leading experts. If this is a space to double into, we have folks like the folks that you mentioned, Walter Longo's, Peter Attia's of the world, come on and talk about their bag. So really amazing. Interesting. Check out the HVMN podcast. We're at hvmn.com. We're at HVMN on all the social networks. Me, myself, I'm Michael Brandt. You can find me at BDM_runner, Twitter, Instagram, everywhere. Pretty active out there. Love to hear from people what you're building on the business level, what you're doing in your personal life, training for a marathon, doing a fast, getting your first 1,000 customers on your business. Love to hear from people, whatever you're doing. So say hello.
Amazing, man. Well, thanks again for being here, man. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to hanging out with you very soon in California as well. And hope you all enjoyed this, and let us know what you think on Twitter. And really appreciate your time today, man. And I'll see you soon.
Thanks, Bilal.
Cheers, man. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can also watch all of these visually, plus bonus clips on youtube.com/CreatorLabFM. If you enjoyed the show, let me know what you think. You can say hello to me on Twitter. I'm at BZAIDI, or CreatorLabFM on any other channel. I really appreciate it. It helps spreading the word with your friends and colleagues. It helps to get this out to more people and allows me to get better guests for you guys. And lastly, if you want access to exclusive content and free giveaways like the recent books that we gave out, make sure you're subscribed to the email list. I'll send out an occasional email with lessons learned from the episode. So if you're interested in that, and of course the free giveaways, who doesn't like those, go to creatorlab.fm/subscribe. Until then, I'll see you on Twitter and speak to you next week.